Day is March 7th, 2019. The first item on our calendar today is the matter of Charlotte Only versus Regency Home Healthcare. This matters docket number A18-1238. Council for appellant will have 15 minutes to argue. Council for respondent will then have 15 minutes to argue, followed by 5 minutes of rebuttal. And please identify yourself and identify who you represent. If you need to adjust the podium, there's a button on the podium to do so, and council can proceed when council is ready.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Max Heerman, representing Charlotte Only. Also with me at council's table is Judah Druck from the Maslin firm. I'm going to dispense with talking about the background facts with the case. They're adequately covered in the briefs, and just dive right in.
Can I ask you just one question about that? What period are we talking about? Because I know there was some issue about that, and I just want to confirm.
Well, that's exactly where I was going to go, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think maybe the best way to talk about this appeal is to break it into some time periods. The first time period would be November 5th, 2017, until December 19th, 2017. And this is the time period that was not the subject of the notice that Ms. Only and Regency received. But it's the time period that the unemployment law judge decided to expand into. So he expanded the temporal scope of the hearing into that time period.
But didn't your client agree to that, though? I mean, wasn't she asked if I can set a separate hearing? And
well, she did finally.
I'm ready to go.
She did finally say on the record, "I'm ready to talk about this." The word "this," I think, is maybe a little hard to understand what she was referring to there. But even
why it seemed like she understood what he was talking about, because she said, "Well, wait a minute, isn't this something that had already been covered? Isn't this issue that's already been addressed?" So my reading of the record did not seem to reflect any confusion on her part as to what this was, i.e., what the issue was.
Well, we would take issue with that. At least three times on the record before she was finally persuaded to say, "I'm ready to talk about this," by the unemployment law judge, she indicated that she was not comfortable talking about the earlier time period in the hearing. She said it in the transcript at 13, which is in our addendum at 26. She said it again in the transcript at 14, which is the addendum at 27. And she said it in the transcript at 18, which is in the addendum at page 33.
Right, but that's a different issue. The issue that I thought you were talking about is what this meant. I don't think there was any confusion as to, I think what your argument is, if I understand it correctly. Well, I think you're raising a separate argument. Let you articulate.
Even if it's clear to the court that by this she meant she was ready to talk about the expanded temporal scope, I still think there's two problems with that. First of all, an unemployment law judge who has a duty to assist both parties perhaps should not be asking an unrepresented individual who's applying for unemployment benefits, after she's indicated three times that she's not comfortable going into an expanded temporal scope, to continue to ask until he gets the answer that he wants. That's one problem.
Counsel, didn't the unemployment law judge ask Ms. Only if she wanted to continue the hearing to a later date?
He did, but again, this was after she indicated on the record three times that she wasn't comfortable. And I think it's a fair reading of the transcript to conclude that she felt that she had no choice but to agree with the unemployment law judge's suggestion.
Are you arguing that the unemployment law judge didn't have the authority to add the expanded time frame to the decision or to the scope of the hearing?
Yes. Under the rule that the department cites, an unemployment law judge can expand the issues. The rule says the issues that are in the notice if the judge gets consent from the parties. We would argue that expanding the temporal scope of the hearing is not the same thing as expanding the issues. And so even under the rule, and even if you believe that consent was given, there isn't authority for the proposition that the temporal period that was noticed can be expanded by the unemployment law judge. So that's another problem.
Do you have any case law to support your position on that point?
No, I don't believe there are any cases where the temporal scope was extended by the unemployment law judge and that was challenged on appeal. The only cases that the department cites are cases where the issues of the time period that was the subject of the notice were extended. They are not cases where the time period itself was extended and approved by a court or where that rule was cited to by the judge as a basis for extending the time period.
You know, I'm just looking at the transcript here, and I just want to make sure I understand your argument about her misunderstanding of this matter, because it looks like the judge, I mean, the transcript seems to indicate the judge explained twice on the record that we're going to have to go into this period, and if you want, that we can set up a second hearing, a separate hearing, or we can, you can waive the right to notice and we can go ahead today. And she did that twice. And I, you know, where in this record is there any indication, you know, based on a direct quote from the transcript, that she didn't understand this?
Well,
because it was explained to her twice.
As I mentioned, on page 13 of the transcript, she says, Ms. Olney says, we already had a hearing about this on December 20th. And then you're right, the unemployment law judge does proceed to try to explain. She says again, because we already had a, and then she, it's kind of indecipherable for a while, but then she comes back to, I had appealed through unemployment in December. That's on in the transcript at 14. Then at 18, I was just trying to explain that what you're talking about from October and November, I was just trying to explain that I already had a hearing on December about it, and that's through. So she keeps coming back to either expressing that she doesn't understand or that she's not comfortable with expanding the temporal scope of the hearing.
Because that issue had already been addressed.
In her view, it had.
Didn't the judge clarify that the unemployment law judge clarify that the time frame that was the time frame that he was concerned about was November 4th going into December and into January, and that he was going to be looking at availability for suitable employment beginning November 4th, which is after the time frame that she had been discussing?
Yes, he did say those things to Ms. Olney, and he did attempt to explain to her. Our point is that the record indicates that she was confused or not comfortable expanding the temporal scope until she felt that she had no choice but to consent.
Well, except here's, I'm just reading it, and I just want to make sure that I'm not missing anything here. Her answer was, I'm trying to think of what you're saying because I was just trying to explain what you're talking about from October and November 1, or November, I was just trying to explain. I already had a hearing in December about it, and that's through. And then the judge says, but Ms. Olney, you withdrew the appeal on that issue, and that issue only covered the period of October 22 through November 4. So they're on the same page, it sounds like, on what was covered in that prior hearing. And what I'm telling you is, based on the information I'm hearing today, I think there's an issue of your availability for suitable employment for November 4 going forward into December, into January. So I'll be looking at that, and then she again explains that I can set this up for a separate hearing. You're entitled, you know, that you have to waive notice if you, you know, want to proceed today.
Mm-hmm.
And then she, her response, which she says, no, I'm ready to discuss this. I mean, how is that equivocal?
Well, as I say, when you look at the total, at the record in its totality, where Ms. Only mentions at least three times she's not comfortable expanding the scope.
Well,
and
where
then,
does she say that, though? What can you point to in this transcript where she actually says, I am not comfortable expanding this hearing?
It's the three places in the transcript that I mentioned earlier. I don't have any additional sites for the court.
Assuming we were to agree with you that the scope was expanded improperly, as you're alleging, wouldn't the proper remedy be to remand it back so she could have an additional hearing rather than reaching the remedy that you're suggesting, which is allowing her to retain the unemployment compensation benefits paid to her? Because if legally she wasn't entitled to those benefits, I mean, shouldn't that be resolved after a full hearing if it was improper to expand the scope, as you're alleging?
Yes, a remand would be an appropriate remedy. We would prefer a reversal, but a remand would also be appropriate. I'd like to...
I want to go back to the issue, because you were asked if you were actually challenging whether or not Dita had the authority to expand the scope, and the point you're focusing on is that the temporal, looking at a different temporal, a different time period, is not a separate issue. I'm still struggling with that, because even the ULJ characterized it in his colloquy with her about that's a separate issue. And the separate issue is that whether or not she was available for suitable work, suitable employment, during the time period of November 5th through December 19th. So it seems to me that the focus on the temporal is taken away from the bigger issue, that's a separate issue that's being raised that she thought had been resolved already, and the ULJ spotted this and said, okay, we can either do this now or we can do it later.
Mm-hmm.
How is that not a separate issue?
Well, all of the cases that the department cites to where courts have confirmed a expansion of the scope of an unemployment hearing have been cases where the time period that was at issue isn't changed, but let's say the notice says that the issue that's going to be decided at the hearing is whether you were available for suitable employment, and then the unemployment law judge says, well, during that same time period, now I think we also need to deal with another issue, whether you were enrolled in reemployment training or not. And the courts have said that's perfectly appropriate, and that makes sense in terms of efficiency. But when you say that the rule allows for expanding the temporal scope of the hearing, that's different, because it puts the unemployment benefit, the individual who is seeking unemployment benefits, sort of a double jeopardy. They now don't just have, say, $1,500 at issue. They've got $3,000 at issue. And they're asked to talk about a time period and facts that they weren't prepared for based on the notice of the hearing.
What facts or testimony would your client have presented if she had advance notice of the expansion of the time frame?
Well,
I don't see any recitation of that in your brief. I just see an argument that there was prejudice.
Yes, and there are a number of times in the record where she mentions, but the unemployment law judge doesn't follow up, some steps that she had taken, where she had submitted resumes, where she says at one point she went to an agency. She may be able to expand upon those points if there were a remand. And if I could...
In terms of her efforts to seek employment?
Yes. And also, if I could just mention the time period of December 1st to December 19th. So even if the court were to find that expanding the temporal scope of the hearing was proper, there really isn't any basis on the record for concluding that Ms. Only refused an offer of suitable employment during that December 1st to the 19th time period. She said in the voicemail message, that's a key piece of evidence in the record, that she was not going to be available in November, but then she says, I'll be back in December. She says it twice. And also in the record, unchallenged by Regency, it was their practice that they would contact her, not vice versa, when work was available. So from December 1st to December 19th, she had told them she was available to work, and they don't even allege that they called her.
Doesn't she have an obligation to call them under the
statute? She did call them. She called them in early November, and she said, I'm taking a month off, skipping down, so I won't be able to start back work until December, and then skipping down again. I will be back by December. This actually is not in the addendum, but it is in the record. It was Exhibit 8 to the hearing, and it's page 2 of 3. It's a message that she left and that Regency provided a transcript of from Thursday, November 2nd, 2017. So they were on notice that she would be available in December and didn't call.
Didn't she represent, though, in that November telephone conversation that she was going to be out, you know, through the month of November, but she'd be back in December, and that she would keep in touch?
She did say that, but it reads more like kind of a way you wrap up a voicemail message when you're about to hang up. I think the key points were that she said pretty clearly she'd be back in December and that she was just going to be off a month in a message that she left on the second day of November.
Okay, counsel, I see your time is up. You'll have 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Ann Froelich, and I represent the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development in this matter. We request that this court affirm the decision of the unemployment law judge as it is legally and factually correct. I'd like to start with the issue of whether the ULJ properly notified the applicant of the new issue to be determined. I disagree with counsel. Ms. Only never said she was uncomfortable expanding either the temporal scope or the issue to be discussed at the hearing. Rather, she appeared to understand quite well what the issue was that the unemployment law judge was raising, that it was availability and actively seeking.
I mean, wasn't that the issue throughout the entire period? Wasn't that the issue that was under consideration?
The issue before the unemployment law judge initially in this case was whether she refused or avoided an offer of suitable employment, but the hearing that she's referencing from the prior hearing she's referencing, that was the issue at that hearing, whether she was available for suitable employment and actively seeking suitable employment. So she is aware enough to know that that's what that other ULJ was going to discuss until she withdrew that appeal. And appears, if she is confused, it appears that she's confused regarding what the impact of the withdrawal of that former appeal is. But she knows the issue is availability and actively seeking. And in fact, if she was prepared for the former hearing, then she would at least have done some preparation before the current hearing at issue, in which they do ultimately address whether she's available for suitable employment and actively seeking suitable employment.
Did the ULJ have the authority to expand the time frame that was being considered under Rule 33.10.2910?
Yes, Your Honor. The ULJ, as it says, can address other issues. Now, to limit it to that specific time frame is an artificial limitation on the ULJ's authority. For instance, if they were having a conversation between an applicant and an employer, and there was an issue that came up that there had actually been a separation, that separation might not have occurred during the time frame that was at the issue in the original determination. But to say then the ULJ couldn't address that separation because it occurred before or after the time frame in the determination, that creates another level of, it limits the ULJ's ability to act under that rule. If the rule wanted to limit it to only the time frame at issue, it would have said so. And this court shouldn't impose additional requirements that aren't clearly written into that rule. If there are other questions on the waiver, please let me know. Otherwise, I'd like to address briefly the credibility issues that Ms. Olney raised in her brief. Ms. Olney wants to impose additional requirements on the ULJ, such as making credibility assessments with reference to specific time periods rather than making a general credibility assessment and giving Ms. Olney the opportunity to explain inconsistencies within her own testimony. The Minnesota Statute Section 268.105, Subdivision 1A, Paragraph A, requires the ULJ to set out the reason for crediting or discrediting an applicant or other party's testimony. It doesn't impose an additional time frame requirement. It doesn't require the ULJ to set out individual credibility assessments on various pieces of testimony. It just says that the ULJ needs to explain that. And in this case, the ULJ explained both why Ms. Olney's testimony was not credible and why Ms. Bridgman, the employer's representative, why her testimony was credible. That is sufficient under the statutory requirements. With regard to giving Ms. Olney the opportunity to explain her inconsistencies, an unemployment law judge is not required to believe anyone's testimony, even if that testimony is not directly controverted by another party. And in that case, the unemployment law judge merely needs to explain the reasons that, in this case, he made the credibility assessment that he did. And again, that was done.
I have a question regarding the requirement that she actively search for work, including
yes.
from her last employer. Why wasn't her phone call to them in early November saying, this is my availability in November and in December, why wasn't that sufficient to meet her statutory obligation?
Minnesota Statute 268.085, Subdivision 16, Paragraph B, says that it's when reasonable, an employee must notify employers from whom they've been laid off to request additional work to see if there's work available. In this case, Ms. Olney called the employer and said, I'm going out of town. She never called the employer to say, I'm back in town or I never went out of town. And she never called the employer to say, hey, heads up, I'm still available. Is there anything here now?
Wasn't it her experience in the past, though, that the employer would call her when there was something available? Wasn't it reasonable for her to assume that that would happen in this case or during this time period as well?
I think there's two separate issues. One is whether that's reasonable based on her common practice. The other is whether she's actively seeking suitable employment under the statute. And to be eligible for unemployment benefits is a higher barrier than just, or a higher standard than just waiting for employment to come your way. It requires that you actively seek employment. And I would argue that even in those words themselves, it requires you to take action. And then additionally, we have the requirement that you call past employers to determine if work is available for you. And her efforts at one, not calling them and letting them know she's not available, and then she says she's waiting for a call from them, but then she later says that the number they're calling is a fax machine at which she can't receive messages. So if she is indeed waiting for them to call her, it's not very persuasive that she thinks they can get through to her. So she needs to give them a number that will work consistently in which they can leave messages. Otherwise, she needs to call them to make sure she's receiving calls and not missing calls from them. And in this case, we have her in the November call, as you mentioned, saying, I'll be out for November. But then we have her calling back in January as well and saying, I need to stay on unemployment. And while she doesn't state that she meant she couldn't work by that, and you can indeed work part-time and receive unemployment benefits in some cases, that's not common knowledge. And it was certainly reasonable for the employer to interpret that as she can't continue working. And in fact, for Ms. Only to continue working and be eligible for unemployment benefits, she would have had to work less than 15 hours a week. And so possibly she could have done that. But she,
and she worked regularly, what, 12 hours?
12 hours. So it would be consistent. She could have continued working her, assuming she stayed at the same rate of pay, the $11.56 an hour. She could have continued working that 12 hours a week and received unemployment benefits. But that's not what she told the employer. She didn't say, I can work up to 12, 15 hours a week. She said, I need to stay on unemployment benefits. And again, she needs to show that she's actively seeking suitable employment, that her attachment to the workforce is genuine, and the comments that she's repeatedly making to Regency Home Healthcare don't show that she sincerely wants to return to work. Rather, they show her making efforts to at least, might make the employer call her, put her lower down on their list before calling her.
Didn't the employer testify that when she called in November, she indicated she would get in touch with the employer when she got back, and she didn't do that?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. There is no evidence in the record that she contacted the employer between the November 2nd call, in which she indicated she was going out of town, and then I believe it's January 12th is when she called and made the comment about needing to stay on unemployment.
And as in reviewing the record, there were two phone calls made to her, according to the employer, saying there's work here, give us a call, correct?
Yes, there were additional calls made to her in October before she made the December call, and then also in December after they found out through the unemployment paperwork that she was indeed in town and didn't go out of town.
All right. And I think she indicated that she didn't get both calls, but the ULJ indicated she didn't find that to be credible.
Correct.
And she did call back, I think it was in January.
Correct.
And said, I got your call. I mean, she acknowledged she got at least one of the calls.
Correct. And that's when she said that she got the voicemail through her fax machine. And then the January call again was when she said she needed to stay on unemployment. Okay. One other piece, Ms. Only argues that she was in reemployment assistance training and that because she was in reemployment assistance training, she does not need to be actively seeking suitable employment or available for suitable employment. To be in reemployment assistance training, you need to be in training, full-time training now, or that training needs to start within 30 days. The hearing took place on March 6th, and at that time, Ms. Only testified that the next course she could start was on May 29th. So even if you believe Ms. Only's testimony and give her a little bit of benefit of the doubt that she was actually scheduled to start on May 29th, which is a little more ambiguous in the record of whether it was actually scheduled, she wouldn't be in reemployment assistance training as that's more than 30 days from the March 6th hearing. Ms. Only argues that she did everything she could do to try to get in training and that it was for reasons beyond her control, and therefore it's unfair to deny her. But Minnesota Statute 268.069, Subdivision 3, specifically states that there is no equitable or common law denial or allowance of unemployment benefits, and so the deed cannot give her unemployment benefits because it was beyond her control that she couldn't start the reemployment assistance training. And furthermore, all she wouldn't have needed to do to be eligible for benefits during that time is be available for work and actively seeking work when she wasn't in training.
But even if we assume, for the sake of argument, that she enrolled November 17th, why isn't that enough, the fact that she enrolled? Isn't she taking reasonable steps to enter into that dislocated worker program?
The dislocated worker program is much broader than just full-time training. The dislocated worker program includes resume writing help, interview help. It includes resources that could be one-off training here or there. It's not all full-time training, and the statute specifically requires that you need to be in to be in reemployment assistance training. If you're in the dislocated worker program attending full-time training, that is sufficient. But she's in the dislocated worker program attending no training or at least one-off trainings until at least May 29th. So she doesn't meet the requirements that are specifically laid out in the statute. And it's not enough just to enroll in the dislocated worker program. You have to actually be in reemployment assistance training or start that training within 30 days. And again, that's full-time training.
Within 30 days of what date?
Of the beginning of the yes, within. So if she was starting training, for instance, on March 30th, then on March 6th when the hearing took place, that would be sufficient to say that she was in reemployment assistance training at that time. But those aren't the facts. The facts that we have are she may have been enrolled beginning May 29th. And DEED has no information from Ms. Only showing when she actually did start the training. So she's never reported that I am in training now or I'm going to start in 30 days. So we have no knowledge of the specifics of that.
But if she provided evidence that she was actively seeking work, that would be sufficient in place of the training.
Correct. If she provided evidence that she was available for suitable employment and actively seeking work, it wouldn't matter that she was in reemployment assistance training. The only reason reemployment assistance training matters is because if she is in the reemployment assistance training, then she's exempted from being the requirement of being available and actively seeking.
So that takes us back to the waiver issue, and counsel for Ms. Only argues that Ms. Only would have presented additional evidence about her efforts to seek work. Did the ULJ give her a fair opportunity in that regard in this hearing?
The statute, again, specifically requires that employees call former employers. And in this case, Ms. Only failed to do that. So that in and of itself shows that she's not actively seeking suitable employment. The easiest way for her to go back to work would be to call Regency Home Healthcare and tell them, I want to work, do you have clients available to me? She's choosing not to do that, and she, as the ULJ finds, never provides a reasonable explanation for her choice not to respond. So even if she was looking for jobs elsewhere, it was insufficient to overcome that obligation. And with that, I'm out of time. We respectfully request that this court affirm the decision of the unemployment law judge. Thank you.
Thank you.
With regard to the credibility determination and the messages that the department says that they left with Ms. Only on December 20th and on December 28th, I'd just like to point to an interesting fact in the record, and I apologize, this isn't in the briefs. I didn't notice this until I was preparing for the oral argument. But if you look at page 1 of the transcript, the unemployment law judge actually calls Ms. Only, and in the record it says she called Ms. Only at a 2142 number. Ms. Only does not pick up. Then in the transcript at page 2, the ULJ calls Ms. Only at a different number, and she does pick up, and she says, oh yeah, I've been waiting. Later in the transcript, when Ms. Only is talking about this evidence that Regency brought that they had left messages for on the 20th and the 28th, she says that the fax line is the 2142 number. That's in the transcript at page 23. So that evidence in the record tends to substantiate her claim that she has two lines. One of them is attached to a fax, one of them is a phone line. If someone calls the line that's attached to the fax, she doesn't get it. She didn't get the messages on the 20th or the 28th. And the credibility
but
determination.
She actually says on page 23 of the transcript, page 36 of the addendum, I will get a message through, sometimes through my fax machine.
Yes, and that's a confounding point in the record. Frankly, I'm not sure what that's based on. But it appears from the totality of the record that what happened is if someone called her fax machine line, she wouldn't get the call. If someone called her phone line, which is what happened on January 9th, she did get that voicemail message from Regency, and she called back a couple of days later.
But didn't she have an obligation to call her employer once she her plans in November change to let them know she was available for work?
Well, the statute requires that the efforts, as the court stated earlier, be reasonable. And it is unrefuted in the record that the practice had been for Regency to contact Ms. Only when work was available. She left a voicemail message in early November saying she'd be available again in December. They didn't call her. They say until December 20th, and she says she didn't receive a call from them until January 9th.
But she said at the phone call that she left, and you raise a good point there, your earlier point, even though it was in the brief, it's a fair one, I think, to raise. But even if that part of her testimony is credited, it's still her obligation, and yes, it's reasonable, but when she says in early November in her call, I'll keep in touch, and it seems reasonable that the employer would then be waiting to hear back from her when she returns to say, okay, I'm available for employment now. Give me a call if something comes up.
Well, there isn't really anything in the record to support that was the practice between these two parties. She testified that the practice was for Regency to be the one who reached out to her, and Regency did not disagree with that testimony.
Although if she was really interested in working when her plans changed, do you think she would have reached out to Regency?
Not based on the testimony here about the practice between the parties. And she had been employed with Regency since 2013. So this was a long-standing practice where when work was available, they would contact her, not vice versa. And they apparently knew to contact her on her phone line and not on her fax line until there was this misunderstanding on December 20th and on December 28th, and they called the other number.
You know, how can we as a reviewing court, though, deal with this inconsistent testimony as to what occurred here when the judge made a distinctive credibility determination? Don't we have to defer to that credibility determination?
You only have to defer to a credibility determination if the judge sets forth the reasons why he or she either credits or discredits the testimony. And here that was in a very summary fashion. There is not a itemization, certainly, of the things that the ULJ found to be credible about the Regency's testimony or uncredible about Ms. Only's. And particularly in light of what's in the transcript about these two phone numbers and the judge herself not being able to reach Ms. Only when calling the fax line, the credibility determination does not seem to be supported by the record.
Well, but I'm looking on page 8 of the addendum, and it seems like the ULJ did support its credibility determinations and went into some details as to why the ULJ did not find her testimony credible. So it wasn't just a conclusory statement that relator's testimony wasn't credible, period, and stop right there. The ULJ does go into some details of she was unable to provide reasonable or convincing explanation for failure to contact them about returning to work, for example, which that seems pretty reasonable. So it does look like there are some facts to support that conclusion.
Well, I see that I'm out of time, but we would argue that, in fact, that it is not a satisfactory, did not satisfy the duty of setting forth the reasons for discrediting her testimony.
How much would have had to be there then, and what case law would support a more detailed analysis? There has to be something there, I agree with you there, but it does seem, and it's not extensive, the ULJ didn't go on for pages and pages, it's just paragraph or two, but why isn't that sufficient? And what case law would support this not being enough here?
Well, I can't cite to you any case law, but for example, a number of the points that we've been talking about at this hearing really are not at issue. There was Ms. Only's testimony about what happened, and then no testimony to counterbalance it. And the unemployment law judge, if he or she is going to determine that the opposite of what the unchallenged testimony is in fact the truth, that would need to be set out in greater detail than what is done here.
But you just said you don't have any authority to that. And to Judge Hooten's point, this is a credibility determination. The fact that there's no other testimony doesn't mean that the ULJ isn't entitled to either credit or discredit part or all of her testimony.
This court gives deference to, we would agree that this court should give deference to credibility determinations if this court finds that the determination is set forth in sufficient detail as required by the statute and supported by, reasonably supported by the facts. And in our view, neither of those are present here.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Matter was